Eh?
Eh?
You gonna tell me how good I look? I lost 15.
Pounds? Wow!
Ounces! My clothes are hanging off me! Yeah. Oi, Colt. Please tell me those ain't Heisenberg Brothers bagels. I haven't had bread for months. I've had a wall here for a Kaiser roll or something starchy. Oyster crackers. Anything! A sandwich without bread isn't a sandwich! It's meat with mustard on your hands!
Hi, and welcome to another episode of We Talk Funny. I'm your host, Ken Pringle. And today, I'm going to be speaking with a voice actor that you have heard in everything from major AAA video game titles like Apex Legends to classic Adult Swim fare like Harvey Birdman, Attorney at Law. And if you're a Simpsons fan, well, he's the voice of basically half of Springfield, as he's appeared in over 200 episodes of The Simpsons. It's Mr. Chris Edgerly. Now, to celebrate, in classic Saturday morning style, I'm having a bowl of cereal again. And today's cereal, I'm going to go on record and say today's cereal might be my current favorite cereal. It's a cereal known as Chocolate Frosted Flakes. And if you haven't tried it yet, you're not alone. See, Kellogg's has actually tried to launch Chocolate Frosted Flakes 3 different times in the United States. Originally in 1997, it only lasted until 2000. Then they tried again in 2011, and it was gone in a year. Then again in 2013, and it seems to be sticking around since then, although it can still be kind of hard to find in grocery stores sometimes. But I will go on record and say, greatest chocolate cereal on the market. That's right. I will take this over Cocoa Puffs. I will take this over Cocoa Krispies, Cocoa Pebbles, whatever chocolate cereal you like. This tops them all. It is so good. I highly recommend you try it. And to top it all off, not only does it have great chocolate flavor, but it has the best chocolate milk. The milk and the cereal's gone. It's so much more chocolatey than any other cereal out there. It's fantastic. Now, weird fact about Chocolate Frosted Flakes. While in the United States, it's been hit and miss for success, it's actually one of the most successful cereals in Central America as well as South America, where it's been sold for years under the name Choco Zucaritas. In fact, it's so popular down there, and has been for years, there's even a special version of it with marshmallows, which I can't wait to try, and I hope I have one Mexican podcast listener who is willing to ship me Choco Zucaritas with marshmallows. That sounds incredible. But for now, grab whatever your favorite Saturday morning breakfast cereal is, big bowl, sit back and relax, and as we always say here at the podcast, spoons up, let's dig in. And welcome to We Talk Funny. I'm your host, Ken Pringle. And with us today, one of my favorite voice actors. You'll know this gentleman from almost 200 different TV shows and video games at this point, which is an incredible number. You've heard him in over 250 episodes of The Simpsons. You've heard him in the video game Apex Legends. You've heard him in Naruto. And my personal favorite, as he knows, he is the voice of Peter Potamus from Harvey Birdman, Attorney at Law, a show that is very near and dear to my heart. Please welcome my buddy Chris Edgerly, everybody. Yay!
Hey, hey! What's up, brother?
Hey, Chris. Thanks for joining me on here. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course, man. Of course. You're one of my favorites on the live show, so I had to get you on the podcast version, too.
Yeah.
So, because, like the show, this is the podcast is, you know, devoted to Saturday morning cartoons and video games and everything that right. We enjoyed as kids, I always want to ask, what were your Saturday mornings like growing up? Were you a Saturday mornings cartoons kind of kid, or were you more afternoon cartoons, or did you not like cartoons, or what?
No, absolutely a Saturday morning kid. I mean, late Friday afternoon, once you were back home from school, I was already in a state of grace because I was done with the week. And then we would just start thinking about what shows were going to come on tomorrow morning. I remember, I'm pretty old, but I remember in the late 70s, the Osmonds, because they were huge in the 70s, the Osmond family had a variety show, and they did a Saturday morning sneak peek. They did it on Friday night. Yeah, they did a special, and they gave you little clips of the cartoons that were going to air the next morning. And so we watched that and could not wait. And I would get up early. We would run down to the TV, and I'm not sure what it would start with. A lot of times the cartoons that came on early in the morning were sort of the B team, you mm-hmm. know, the minor leagues. And, you know, you'd sit through those because they were cartoons, because I think a lot of people may not realize this, but you couldn't just watch whatever you wanted at any given moment back then.
Right, right.
We had, we had three regular networks. There was no cable, and we had PBS, and you got to see some old cartoons, maybe from 3:30 to about 5 o'clock after school, maybe if you were lucky. And that's it. So when Saturday morning came, that was your entire allotment of cartoons for the week. There were no recording methods. There was no VHS, none of that yet, at least not widespread. So when Saturday morning cartoons came on, I was there. That was my appointment, TV. And so for me, obviously, everything built up to Looney Tunes. Yeah. I remember Bugs Bunny would get an hour and a half for different Looney Tunes clips and little interstitials. I remember watching, this is going way back, but I would watch Clue Club. I would watch, that one, you'll have to look that
up. Clue Club, I'm trying to remember that one.
Yeah, exactly. I would watch, obviously anything Scooby-Doo. A lot of times we would catch that after school. But on Saturday mornings, I remember Dungeons and Dragons, the cartoon,
when
it came out in the early 80s. That was right in the pocket for me. What else? Frankly, all of them. I would try to hit every single cartoon. We used to watch He-Man. Yeah. And then I had a little brother who was 10 years younger than me. So when he was about 2 or 3, I would watch the cartoons that he liked.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
a lot of kids today don't realize, you know, how different it was when you only had access a certain amount of time. That the traditional Saturday morning programming block would start at 7 o'clock in the morning, and it would run from 7 o'clock in the morning until 1 p.m., which is usually when they would go to some sort of Saturday syndicated stuff. I know that I grew up in Alaska, so up there it was like Three Stooges afterwards and things like that. But yeah, I remember that for the last hour and a half was Bugs Bunny. Like that was. That's how they closed out that block of programming.
Yeah.
And you had to get up early to catch some of those shows. I mean, me growing up in Alaska, we were in an earlier time zone. So if I wanted to watch like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles or something, I had to be up at 5 o'clock in the morning. It was insane.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you did it.
Right. And in the 70s, a lot of times they'd have live action shows for kids. And so I remember watching Shazam live action. I watched Isis, a live action show, because I had a crush on the woman who played Isis. So, yeah. And you could look all that stuff up, but I was all about it.
So with all these different cartoons, did you have a favorite? Was there one in particular that was just the show?
It changed because as you get older, your tastes change. Sure. You hit these developmental stages and you want your cartoons to be a little bit older, too. So, yeah, I mean, I really did. I was glued to the TV for anything Warner Brothers. And that's been the same my entire life. And, I got to go back to, I would say, like, the Dungeons and Dragons cartoon probably came out when I was about 13. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're starting to get near the end of your cartoon watching years. But I would definitely sit for that one for sure.
Yeah, that was a fun one.
Yeah, I remember when the Smurfs came out, I was big into them.
I love
I was
the
about
loved
11. It. Yeah, and they hit, and I was really into them for a year or two.
Yeah, my first animation cell that I had back when I was trying to collect animation cells was a 5-cell, 7-character Smurfs setup. And I was just like, I have to own this.
Wow.
It was beautiful. Mm-hmm. And then Saturday mornings when you're watching these cartoons, did you have a favorite breakfast cereal? Did you go and get the big bowl of cereal with all of it?
Yeah, we had multiple bowls of cereal. Obviously, anything sugary, but I remember Frosted Flakes probably were my number one. But I loved Fruity Pebbles. I loved Cocoa Pebbles. Mm-hmm. I loved Count Chocula. We got all the monster cereals: Count Chocula, Boo Berry. We would get those. The lesser cereals like Honeycomb, I would abide that, but the sugar content was just not nearly high enough. So, yeah, mainly I could wipe out several bowls of Kellogg's Frosted Flakes.
You know, we talk about cereal a lot on this show because I'm a big cereal buff. And one of the cereals I've talked about is a lot of people haven't tried them, but the chocolate Frosted Flakes, which oddly enough are more popular in Central America than they are in the U.S.
Interesting.
One of the best cereals I've ever had, because I like Frosted Flakes myself, but the chocolate Frosted Flakes blows Cocoa Puffs and all the other chocolatey cereals out of the water. They're just incredible.
Wow.
So, well worth a try. I highly recommend them.
That's a cheat day item for me then.
So we're going to talk about your comedy career in a bit, because I know you started out with a lot of stand-up and things. And
right.
We've both done stand-up quite a bit. Which did you find yourself attracted to first, VO or comedy?
Before I knew, I knew that there were people that did voices professionally, because you're watching these shows and you can't help but notice how mm-hmm. great they are at this. But it didn't occur to me that I would be working in that field till I was older. So I did voices, obviously. Any character I thought I could mimic, I would do them. And I would do them for my brothers and then for my friends. And then I started writing down a list of the voices I could do. But I did not approach it as a professional kind of gig until I was in my 20s. And stand-up, I was, I would usually crack my friends up any way I could since I was a kid. And I did not entertain the idea of doing stand-up until I was in college. So mm-hmm. one shortly followed the other. But I would say the one I did professionally first was stand-up. Mm-hmm. But close on its heels was acting and voice acting. So that as I began to perform for audiences, I also began to pursue any kind of acting opportunity I could find. And this was all on the East Coast. So I got into stand-up when I was in college at University of Georgia. And then once I was done with college, I moved down to Orlando with a buddy that I had done stand-up with in college. And after, a few months of doing some stand-up gigs, I thought, now let me go ahead and cold call an agency and just see if I can get an interview. In Orlando, you could do that. I mean, I guess you could do it here too in LA, but it's harder to break that, break through that barrier. But in Orlando, you could cold call an agency, get yourself a meeting, and, get yourself representation if you could do a monologue. So that's what I did.
Nice. What was your first pro club as a comic?
The first professional gig I did as a comic was with several other comics at University of Georgia. We were hired to perform for a frat party.
Ooh.
They paid us, not much, but they paid us a little bit. So we technically thought, all right, that was a pro gig. But as far as performing as a professional, being paid to do the entire week, it was the Comedy House in Savannah, Georgia. They would have me fill in and MC, because I would go to the open mic every Tuesday night. I would be there for open mic, and they would let on three open micers. And depending on how you did, you could come back. And I would usually do the best of the three. And so they would put me on third of the three open micers, and then they finally let me MC some. And then my first road gig was in Ocala, Florida, at a comedy house there. And I basically tanked the entire week. I just, for whatever reason, whatever I was doing in Savannah was not working in Ocala. And finally on Sunday night, the last night of the week, I broke through and got some laughs. And I thought, okay. So I guess I won't quit the business, but I was considering it.
That is such a stereotypical story for comics. When you first go out on your first road gigs, it's just, if you don't tank, you kind of have to be concerned.
Like, right. It was brutal.
Yeah. I used to, I've taught a lot of comics here in Los Angeles market. And I always tell them, I say, you'll learn more in 2 weeks on the road than you will 6 months of Los Angeles open mics, just because, what plays here, that may not play at a bar in Iowa. Like it's a totally different environment, and you have to go out and get punched in the teeth a bit. It makes you stronger.
It is. And then by the same token, you can pick up bad habits on the road
that
will not translate when you get to LA or New York in industry towns where they know all the hack jokes and mm-hmm. they, don't have any use for them. So you really have to walk a fine line. I never quite figured out how to do it. I was too busy serving the roadmaster so I could move up in the clubs and make better money.
Yeah.
And then whatever it was I would bring to LA for industry sets wasn't specific enough to me to make them remember me. And so that's the line you have to walk. If you're a road comic, you've got to be able to make whatever it is you do work for any crowd. And then you've got to be able to take the best elements of that, if you have to reshape it at all, and make it work for an industry and, you know, in a 5-minute set. I mean, I know that the industry has changed anyway, because used to be we wanted to get on one of the comedy shows, or you wanted to do a set on one of the talk shows and put your shingle out that way for people to discover you. Now, it helps if you're on one of those shows, but if you build up enough of a social media following, you don't need those shows.
Oh, not at all. It's completely different. I mean, it used to be back in the day that, you know, getting a spot on Carson, like, that would make you. That was just, I mean, that was the thing. And honestly, there's not a lot of comics out there now that don't have some kind of credit like that. And it just doesn't carry the cachet anymore. But I mean, I don't want to drop names here, but I've coached some major YouTube influencers and taught them stand up who are out. They're not great comics, but they have such a fan base that they can sell out a club for a week. And so they'll just go out and, you know, do comedy on the road, and it's no problem for them. It's a very different environment now, certainly. As far as you know, working the road all the time, that's always sort of the weird thing, because you can't make a living doing just stand up in Los Angeles. But at the same time, I remember going to the Improv, and I would see comics coming to the Improv, and they'd complain that they couldn't get booked there. And the joke was that they had road stink on them, because there's stuff you can do to make an audience laugh in a bar, but there's nothing that makes it unique when you're actually in front of producers and casting directors. You know, there's plenty of comics I've seen that can, you know, they can have a solid hour long set at some bar in the middle of nowhere, but you're not going to build a sitcom around it, because it's not telling a story. There's nothing about it that says this is a unique person that we can build a character around or a show around or even just insert into something.
Yeah, you could hand their bits to another comic and they could do them. And they would do relatively well with them, and there'd be no distinctive mark there. There'd be nothing, like you said, for them to remember you by. And I used to do 40 minutes of straight material, and I would end with impressions. And that's what everyone remembered.
Yep.
And I used to fight that, because I thought, I also like to write. And I also like to, you know, maybe do a character or two or whatever it was. But it didn't matter, because I would end with that. And I had to end with it, because it was my strongest stuff as far as audience response. So I stopped fighting it. And I just found ways to do it that were fun for me, that were different. But by that time, I had already segued into voice acting, and I didn't care about making it as a comic anymore.
Yeah.
So my friends, my fellow comics said, you know, your act, like they, you know, liked my act before, but they said, you didn't really distinguish yourself until you stopped doing the road and you stopped caring about whether or not you were going to make it in the clubs or even in the industry. Then you started to do some really fun bits that were very distinctive that nobody else was doing.
Yeah.
And I thought, better late than never, I guess.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of comics, like, they want to go for the joke is the be all end all. It's just, did it get the laugh? And unfortunately, if you're really trying to advance, it all starts to be personal. It has to have something that's unique to you. You know, I used to tell my students all the time, I said, you see with a lot of road comics where they'll have a great set. And if you ask the audience, hey, what'd you think of that comic? Oh, they were so funny. What was your favorite joke?
Yeah.
And they can't remember. They can't tell you. They don't know.
Yeah.
Well, that's going to be the takeaway that you know, the industry has as well. And so it doesn't play. It doesn't play in the markets like Los Angeles. It's a real shame, but it is, you have to be aware of it when you're looking at it as a business and not just, you know, just the laugh.
Right. And there are comics that can do both. There were comics who came up on the road, but they developed a persona and they developed an act around it, and they could kill anywhere. They could go to an industry town and kill. They could go to the road and kill. Without really changing things up, they might tweak it here or there, or they may not bother to do one bit. They may do other bits for the industry, but they didn't change who they were. They didn't change their approach. They figured it out. Those were the ones I admired the most, because it's not easy to do that.
Sure, sure. It's not that the stuff that you're doing in Los Angeles, it's not like none of it will play on the road, but it's harder to make it play on the road. So if you, if you take that harder path, it's going to pay off down the road.
Right.
That's nice.
Yeah, and comedy goes through trends too. There's just a certain style that works. I mean, if you go back to the to the 50s, it was bang, bang, bang. You got to, you know, get the jokes out, get them fast in there, and you'd work on a set, and you would do it all around the country, and then you would do it on TV, because then everyone would have seen it, and they've, well, I can't do this in the clubs now, they've all seen it. But some comics would do, they would get their hour and they would never change it. They would get it. They would never change it. They say, I have it perfect. Then in the 60s, Lenny Bruce starts changing it by being pretty much outside of the box.
Yeah.
Not doing the regular bang, 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 snappy patter, opening it way up. And then you have Pryor and Carlin.
Yep.
Yeah. Basically counterculture. Mm-hmm. And then Bill Cosby, who we remember quite differently.
Yes.
But,
yeah.
But yeah, he was America's dad, and he tells you these stories. And then you have, I mean, these are the mainstream ones too, because Pryor and Cosby became mainstream, but they were like, Pryor was a mainstream comic in the vein of Bill Cosby, and then thought, I don't want to keep doing that. Goes underground, blows up that way, and then becomes mainstream.
Yeah.
Carlin was more of a sort of counterculture, but worked pretty clean for TV. And then he went underground, blew up in his own right. And then you started seeing more political comedy, more esoteric comedy, guys like Robert Klein. That's through the 70s. Then into the 80s, everybody was a comic. And then it was more sitcom oriented. Then in the 90s, alternative comedy. Then in the aughts, I would say it's hard to really pinpoint where it changed, but Dane Cook kind of led this charge of the
So this is something I've actually talked about in my class, and you're exactly right. Dane Cook is, you know, whether you like him or not,
there was a sea change.
He does push that change, because the thing that, in my opinion anyways, that Dane really drove was he did something that people thought was crazy at the time, and it was brilliant, was when he did his first Comedy Central special, his first half hour, he took the money from that and he invested it in a website. Like 25 grand, something like that. And this is back in the late 90s when comics didn't even have websites. Like, it was really rare. And his website was killer. Right. And the smart thing about that, what the sea change was you would go – at the time, you would go to a show for any comic. And you'd be like – you could be sitting next to a stranger and you go, oh, you like so-and-so comic. Oh, so do I. And that's as far as it went. Dane was very smart about building a community around his comedy. He was an early adopter of MySpace. His website was all community. So that when you went to one of his shows, it was, I hate Bees 65. Oh, you're Burger King 62. We had a rapport, and we felt like we had ownership of what we were seeing on the stage now.
Right.
And bringing that personal element into it really allowed him to sort of build this whole us versus the world concept to the comedy, where we had ownership of it, and it was something that we wanted to be connected to beyond just passively viewing. And I think that was the real sea change that you saw in the aughts, where it was more getting even more personal, but getting personal and intimate with your demographic.
Yeah, that was like a business approach he took to it. As far as his act went, I always thought it was interesting that he sort of removed the punchlines. I mean, he had them, but it was really all about the premise and his delivery. He was going to bring you into a premise, and he was going to absolutely hammer you with his performance. And it didn't matter where it went. You were along for this ride.
There's a terminology I would teach called intensity of complaint. And I always said that, you know, Dane's not always the best structured writer, but his ability with intensity of complaint is second to none. He's fantastic with that particular element, and that's what draws that crowd in, where you want to go along for the ride, certainly.
Yeah, I've noticed the latest trend that I can spot, because I don't consume comedy like I used to, but the only thing I can kind of think of is calling it confessional comedy, where a comedian brings you into their life to a degree that a lot of people almost find uncomfortable, but they share stuff with you. It's almost like you're their therapist and they're opening up. And the guy I saw do it, he had a special, I think it was on Netflix, was Neil Brennan.
Oh, I love Neil Brennan.
Basically, he's a genius writer, I think, and does great stand-up, but he had three microphones. And he would do, each one had, like, one would be straight stand-up, and then on the other mic it would be just miscellaneous, just random weird jokes. And then the third would be the really confessional stuff that wasn't really built around set up Punchline, it was, I'm going to share this part of my life with you, and it's pretty painful stuff. But you can see where some of the comedy comes from. And I guess I have not seen him yet.
Wow.
But Bo Burnham special.
Inside, I've heard it's amazing. I haven't watched it yet.
But yeah. Like that one idea. Is supposed to be the next sort of iteration of what that is. And I think Hannah Gadsby, and I have not seen Nanette. And a lot of people say it's not really even, they don't think of it as comedy as much as it's sort of a one-person show. But Nanette, I think, changed a lot of people's perception of what comedy was going to be. And like I said, I've not seen it. I'm just sort of remarking on where the medium is kind of going.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's always interesting because people want to laugh. They never not want to laugh. They go into a place, they're expecting to laugh. But if you're two or three generations behind or two or three cycles behind where comedy is, and you get in front of a crowd that wants something that's very contemporary, you're going to wonder, why are they not with me? It's like, it's not that they don't acknowledge that you're a comic. It's just, they're not here for that.
Yeah.
You're doing alternative stuff. They're here for Confession.
Yeah. The world's passed you by. Yeah,
exactly. And that happens. It can happen. You could take stuff. If you were to deep freeze, if you were to Austin Powers, a comic from 97 and, or eight, God forbid, 87 and drop them into an audience today and they take their absolute killer stuff. They would do it now and people would look at them like they were in a museum. Like, well, that's odd. I've not seen this before.
You know? Oh, sure. Yeah. I worked on a project a while back for the classic show Evening at the Improv.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Going back through some of that old footage. And I mean, there's amazing comedians that performed on that show, but watching some of these comics do these sets that are, you know, 35 years old, it's like, wow, it just doesn't hold up. It was very much a product of the times.
Yeah, very much.
Now, you, of course, in your comedy, you've performed on our live show, We Talk Funny, the monthly show that we did over there at Flappers in Burbank that hopefully will be coming back here again soon once the world stops being on fire. So in your own comedy, you talked about doing impressions in stand-up.
Right.
Where do you find the challenges in performing impressions as a stand-up rather than just straight stand-up comedy, what most comics would do traditionally?
Right. The challenge, let's assume you're a good impressionist, and I would call myself a good impressionist. I'm not the world champion. Some of them I do, I think, pretty well. Some of them I have to sell a little more. And it's been a while. In fact, the last time I performed on stage was for you, you know, pre-pandemic.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. It's been a while because I've just been doing other things. But the biggest challenge I faced as a comic that was known as an impressionist was you have to resist getting lazy. Because if you do the voice well enough, they'll clap for you. And sometimes you'll get a laugh just because they're amazed at how well you did it. Mm-hmm. But the danger in that is you'll let the material slide. Yeah. And if you find yourself in front of a crowd that is sort of liking you, and then you bust out the impressions, but you've not really written them well, they're not going to care. Because even if you do the voice really well, you haven't been cracking them up to that point, so they don't trust you as a writer. And so they may give you the, oh, okay, that was good, but they're not going to really be with you. So I realized early on that you can't lean too heavily on them if you're not going to have material with it. So I thought, all right, I've got to have a premise and a joke that works even if I don't have an impression with it.
Right.
So now there are some that are just uniquely specific to an impression. And so the premise and the joke itself are predicated on somebody famous delivering it. But a lot of times you could take a pretty good piece of writing and give it to a voice and elevate it more, give it another dimension. But I always thought that the two things I needed to do, that one was the first one, was the writing. And the second one was do the voice well enough where you don't have to tell them who it is. So don't do the vaudeville style of, I will now perform for you so-and-so in the manner of this. Like, well, and don't do it like the 80s setup. Could you imagine if so-and-so was a so-and-so? I think it would go a little something like this. So that's a museum piece. It's where that belongs. I wanted to sort of, I did all that in my early days because you're figuring it out. But what I would want to do is I would just want to throw it out there. And do it with the bit. And if people got who it was, great. if they didn't get who I was doing, they knew I was doing somebody. And if the joke was well written, they would laugh anyway. And then later on, maybe they figured it out. But I didn't want to spoon feed them unless I had a bit where I think I did it at Flappers. The entire bit is predicated on me having to say the first couple, at least. And that is, if you were a studio PR guy in the 50s, you had to make sure that the press never found out about your famous actors getting into trouble with the law. And so I would basically, you know, have whatever star you could think of from that era getting into horrific run-ins with the law and calling the studio PR guy. And like the first one or two, I would sort of let on who I was doing. And after that, I would just, it would take on its own life. And if a person figured out who I was doing, great. If not, didn't matter.
Yeah. I mean, it's like if you're a non-impressionist stand-up comic, they're still going to do jokes where they have an act out that's the punchline, and it works without us going, oh, that's Ronald Reagan or whatever it is.
Yeah.
You know, and so you're saying that these jokes, even if they don't recognize the reference, it's still an exaggerated act out, just like any other comic would be doing. So the joke can stand alone. The impression just becomes icing on the cake, which is, I think that's a fantastic approach.
Yeah, it should. I mean, it's, I believe in whatever approach challenges you the most, because it will make you a better comic. Like I guess I went for about a year when I was working the road. I would usually do 25, 30 weeks a year. And then I would spend the rest of the time in LA trying to get discovered. But those 25, 30 weeks a year, I would tell myself, okay, you know what? I need to work on my writing more. And so I'm going to eliminate profanity. Because profanity will usually get a laugh. Not if you've done it for the entire set, because now it's white noise. Sure. But if you strategically place a profane word in a joke, it will get a bigger laugh, but it doesn't mean it's better written. Right. And at least at the time, that was not going to guarantee you any kind of set on TV, because you can't curse on TV. So at the time, I told myself, okay, I'm not going to curse. I'm not going to say anything that I couldn't say on, at the very most, you know, like basic cable. And it forced my writing to improve, and it forced my delivery to improve as well. Because if you can't drop that F-bomb for the free laugh, you've got to find a way to deliver that joke that really punches it, that drives it home. And so your delivery, your timing, and your writing all have to improve, which is not to say that I don't believe you should curse on stage. You should say whatever you want. And I think some of my favorite comics of all time are tremendously profane sometimes. And I love it. But for me, I needed to place that obstacle in my way to work around it so I would improve.
Well, I think that looking at it from a business approach, that's a very, very smart idea as well. I mean, I'm not against blue comedy. I've had students that are blue comics.
Yeah.
But I've also told them, understand, it's going to limit where you can work and what you can do with this. You know, for a very brief period, a long time ago, a very unsuccessful brief period, I was an agent, and I represented a lot of comics. And, you know, one of my favorite comics, a guy that I've been friends with for many, many years, is a guy named Ari Shaffir. And Ari is just a blue human being. That's how Ari's brain works.
Right.
I've known Ari for a long time. I couldn't go to Ari and be like, you know, Ari, if you clean up your act, you could do some colleges. Like, that's never going to work. Now, Ari's very successful now, but it took him a long time to find that, because he had to work within the demographic that allowed his brand of comedy. On the other hand, I had another comic that I worked with who I absolutely love, a guy named Dwayne Perkins. Dwayne was very clean. He's very strong as well. But Dwayne, I could book him in clubs, but I could also book him in colleges. He could do TV sets. He could do corporate gigs. He could do all these other things. So it's not to say that one path is better than the other, but just to be aware of the obstacles you're creating for yourself down the road, I think is a smart move.
Yeah. The decisions you have to make as a comedian are the same that every artist has to make. Obviously, if you love it, you want to also make a living at it. And when that decision comes, you have to ask yourself, all right, I want to make a living at it, but if the compromises I have to make in order to work more clubs or to work in more mediums mean that I have to compromise the way that I express myself on stage, can I live with that? In other words, can you clean your act up so you can do a cruise ship, which is the basically, you have to be the least offensive comic on earth to work on a cruise ship. And unless they give you a midnight show, then you can say a couple of PG rated words and that's it.
You have to be
it.
Grandma and clean, and it has to be a lot of material. A lot of material. Yeah.
Right. Or, you know, okay, I could do corporate comedy, in which case, once again, you have to keep it pretty clean. And then there's super clean comedy. You know, there are shows that pride themselves on not just being clean of profanity, but clean of any hint of controversy or innuendo.
There are comics out there that people have never heard of that are making six and seven figures because they do the church circuits.
Make an absolute bank.
Which is an underserved market, but man, it takes a very specific style of comic.
Exactly. So I understand that a person might have to make that choice. And at the same time, you have to ask yourself, what's my long-term goal? Because I never was clear enough with my long-term goal and my approach. I just thought, well, I want to be famous. And I want to have a TV show. And then I want to get into movies. Yeah, blah, 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 the usual. But I didn't really work hard at becoming distinctive. I didn't work hard at having an act that I could personally be proud of. I was too distracted by having to make a living, which meant, all right, I got to get back out on the road. Well, how do I go from feature to headliner? Well, you got to have 45 killer minutes and another 15 that's at least filler. And you got to be able to handle when they drop the checks near the end of your show. And you got to be able to handle following a feature that might be too much like you because they didn't book the show well or whatever it is. And all of that stuff has nothing to do with your artistic vision. That's just the nuts and bolts of being a successful working comic. In the midst of all that, you've got to create your voice. And you've got to be distinctive, and you've got to make sure that you don't compromise what that is in order to make a living at it, or at least whatever compromise you make, you can live with it. If you're lucky, you're a comic that works clean. So, you know, naturally, and whatever it is you naturally do, there are a lot of different venues for you to perform in, or like you say with Ari Shaffir, you just stick to your guns. And you realize that there are a lot of rooms where it's just not going to work for you, but you hang in there until your audience finds you, you figure it out, and then that's what you do. I mean, I never fully committed to just doing the stuff I wanted to do because I knew if I did, it was going to be a few extra years of figuring it out and making it work anywhere and everywhere, and I didn't want to put in the extra time. I will freely admit that. I no longer had the drive to do it, and voiceover popped up, and I grabbed onto that.
Which was definitely a smart move. That's worked out extremely well for you.
It worked out just fine.
Now, transitioning over to that voiceover, how important do you think it is for a voice actor to learn comedic skills outside of voice acting, whether it's stand-up or improv or something along those lines?
Well, if you want to book commercials and animation and almost any other job, you want to have a pretty deep bench. You want to have a nice big toolkit to call on. And live performing of any kind, I think, is vital. And any kind of comedic performing, crucial, because comedy is about not just reading the room, but it's timing. And there are so many pieces of copy that I did that were just commercials. That were either written funny, or they were tried to be, you know, they were trying to be funny, or they were written in such a way that you could see there's a rhythm here, there are beats in here, and you need to be able to hit them. And there's just a certain pace that you can appreciate when you have a comedic performance background. And if you're auditioning for a piece of commercial copy and it's clearly written funny, then I think you have an advantage. The pieces of copy that I never booked were when they said, we want a comic to do this, because then they'll come up with what they think is a comedy routine that's not funny. And I'm sitting here thinking, I would never do this on stage. There's no jokes here. At least you think they're jokes. But no, the stuff I booked that was comedic is when there's clearly a joke. I punched it. I landed it. And that was just based on experience.
I swear there's commercial writers at some ad agency somewhere like, I saw Milton Berle do something just like this. It's going to be great. And yeah, it's terrible. But when there's an interesting idea to it, when there's a very solid premise that plays through, I just did one that I can't talk about now, of course, because it was an audition. But was for a commercial copy, but they had this very funny idea. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't about selling the product. The product was secondary. The product is going to be sold just through the humor, but it was right. about the concept of, you know, what's going on in this world. And the product is, you know, tertiary to it. It was hysterical. It was hilarious. And so, yeah, when I get that kind of script, it's just so much more fun to play with, because right. now it's like, oh, they need somebody who understands the timing. They need somebody right. who understands where the beats are in this and how to not push it, how to let the script be the star, not me trying to, you know, make it funny and punch it up and ruin it by overplaying it. Now, one of your particular skills that you've brought from stand-up into voiceover, like you talked about, was the impressions, which has led to some interesting work. Like right now, you're voicing Gobber for DreamWorks Dragons and Dragons Race to the Edge, which you took over for Craig Ferguson. When you're doing a voice match role like that, how do you go about that? What are some of the challenges that come into a performance like that?
Well, this is where you make the distinction that there's voice matching and there's impressions, you know, and impressions can be exact. It just depends on the person doing them. But for the most part, an impression is usually something you do to crack up a room or to put it in your set and have fun with it. And it doesn't always have to be exactly perfect, because if your delivery is good, if the premise is funny, if the writing is there, it'll go over and it'll work. But a voice match is exactly that. They need the person watching this to believe that the actual person you're matching is saying those words when they're not. So a lot of this will be in ADR situations, automated dialogue replacement, where the star of a movie is not available to loop dialogue that they just couldn't record properly on the day for whatever reason. And you're either going to do a temporary replacement or you're just going to replace that one line. And in that case, they don't care how good your quote unquote impression is. They need to be able to close their eyes, hear the star in the scene talk, and then put in your voice and have you sound exactly like the star and have everyone hopefully be none the wiser.
They need you to be invisible.
Voice matching is an entirely technical exercise. Whereas an impression, you can get the spirit of the person and go over. Like Dana Carvey is a perfect example of this. He's, I think, the best example of it. And he's even said it. He says, my impressions are not exact and they're not really meant to be. It's a caricature of the person. So if you see him do his John Travolta, it's a funny John Travolta, but it's not exact. And he could never book a voice match for John Travolta. Whereas my friend Nolan North has actually voice matched John Travolta. And it doesn't sound like Dana Carvey's because it was a technical performance. So there's your difference. You've right. got to have the ear. And you've really got to be able to almost be a human tape recorder. You've got to listen to what they said and say it right back and make a person who's listening think that there's no difference between the two.
And I do feel like there are a lot of voice actors that sort of make a mistake between the two, especially if it's a broad, widely known voice where they'll say, yeah. Oh, we're looking for this character. And they'll be like, you know, oh, we're looking for a Seth Rogen or something. And they'll go, oh, yeah. Well, I know what Seth Rogen sounds like. No, you know what impressions of him sound like because you've right. heard other comedy bits.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And we're going to play a scene for you right now of Seth Rogen. And then the first thing you say is, well, that doesn't sound like Seth Rogen. No, it doesn't sound like an impression of himself. No, but if you watch the movie, he has levels like every other actor has levels. And the story I always tell is there was a job I booked where I voice matched Giovanni Ribisi, the actor, and it was for the movie Basic, which was a John Travolta movie, oddly enough. And the night before, they said, okay, you got to go to the studio tomorrow. And you know, it's going to be a sort of a last minute booking, but whoever does it the best is going to stay and work. So those are those trial by fire auditions you would have to do when you'd have to actually go in person. And I watched the movie Boiler Room with Giovanni Ribisi in it just to sort of get his voice. And I'm thinking, I don't sound that much like him, but I can get in the ballpark and we'll just see what happens. So we go there the next day. And this is also one of those extra trial by fire auditions where usually they have you go into the studio one by one, stand in front of the screen, hear the scene, do it. And then they say, okay, thanks. Go back out to the lobby and have a seat and we'll let you know. All right. And so you're out there just jawing with the other guys and having fun. You go in, you do your thing, you come back out and you wait and hopefully you book it. In this case, this was one of the two or three times where they say, okay, we're really under the gun here, so we don't have time to bring everyone in individually. Here's the scene, and we're in a little waiting room with the TV, and they play the scene. And the scene in this one is Giovanni Ribisi is in a hospital bed because he's injured, and he's on a lot of like morphine. So he doesn't sound like himself. He sounds slower and lower. And there was a guy before the audition that was talking to the rest of us that was auditioning too, that sounded exactly like Giovanni Ribisi normally sounds. And I thought, well, this guy's going to get it. Then they played us the scene and I realized, oh, okay, I actually have a shot. So the director plays the scene, the ADR director plays the scene. And he goes, okay, did you guys get it? Anyone want to see it again? No, we're good. Okay, go. He points to the first guy and he goes, what? And he goes, do the voice. And he shuts his eyes and he listens. And the first two or three guys were deer in headlights. And then by the time it got around to me, I knew what to do. I sounded like a lower, slower Giovanni Ribisi because I wasn't trying to do an impression of him. I was trying to mimic what they played for me right there. And that's how you book the job. You don't do the impression. You do what they play in front of you, and it doesn't always sound like the person you think you can impersonate.
Interesting. That sounds hellacious having to do with all those other guys like that, but it worked out.
The other thing, having a stand-up comedy background, performing in front of drunk second show Friday night audiences means, oh, well, this doesn't faze me. You know, what's the big deal? You know, yeah, if I don't book it, I don't book it, but at least my you know, ego isn't going to get crushed by a bunch of drunk rednecks. <You know?
laughs> They're going to be polite when they don't like me.
Yeah, exactly. Say, thank you very much. We'll have you come in for something else. Not more like, get off the stage.
I've never met a casting director who was armed with an empty beer bottle. So.
Yeah, exactly. There's no chicken wire behind the glass, you know, like in Roadhouse. So, yeah.
Now, talking about adjusting your read for those little types of things, how does a read vary depending on the medium? Like comedy for a commercial audition versus animation or versus a video game, et cetera? Because, I mean, you have a ton of experience in all of those different arenas.
Right. A lot of it is going to be guided by the breakdown, just by the description of what they want. But even then, if you're reading commercial copy that's for radio, and I know that there's less of that now because celestial radio is just not the same. But there are still spots that play, and they will play just for, I don't know, maybe they play on streaming services that still do ads. So if you're going to do something that is a commercial for radio, you generally need to step it up a little bit. You got to be a little more energetic because they've only got audio to sell you this. And so whatever it is they ask for, you need to give them the radio version of that. Whereas if you're doing a TV spot, or in this case, it could be an internet spot, it could be something that is on cable, who knows, but it's going to be visual as well as audio. And that means you don't have to hit them as hard because they have a visual way to sell you this ad as well. So whatever they ask for, you got to give them the TV version of that, be a little more subtle, almost like the difference between theater acting and on-camera acting. On-camera acting is all right here, the eyes, the face, not so much the body if it's a close-up. Theater is you got to use everything you have. You got to reach the cheap seats. Yeah. So you tailor it as far as energy and intensity go, depending on whether or not it's commercial for radio, commercial for TV. And then if you're talking about animation, whatever they ask for, if it's a show for 6-year-old kids, you can't give them the same read you would give them if it was a show for 14-year-olds that's going to be on Netflix only. So 14-year-olds don't want to watch a character that is designed to appeal to 7-year-olds and vice versa. So you have to know how to tweak depending on who the audience is. And a lot of times, just based on a lot of times they'll give you a rendering of the character. Just based on that rendering, you can tell this is for very young kids. So I've got to make sure that I keep that in mind during the performance. So gotcha. Yeah, you're always tweaking.
Gotcha. And then when you're looking at this, you know, you get sides sent over to you or something. How do you know when to break the rules, whether it's ad-libbing or bringing in something? You know, how would you define your process between giving them the choice that you think is what they're looking for and bringing your own element to it as well?
Right. This is different for everyone. Sometimes for me, it's just my mood. I mean, if this is the hundredth audition I've done like this, where they've asked for this every single time, no matter what the project is, they're always going for kind of the same thing. And I haven't had a whole lot of success giving them what they're asking for. I may say to myself, okay, I'll never know why I haven't booked the others. Sometimes it's just because, yes, you were great, but two other people were even better. So don't change what you're doing, because eventually you'll break through. Other times, you were okay, but there was absolutely nothing distinctive about what you did. It's like with stand-up. Yeah, you made them laugh, but I don't remember anything about you. So if they say, we want a dad in his 30s, and he means well, but he's kind of lame, but he's going to always do his best, and he loves his kids unconditionally. Okay, I can give you that guy, but so can a bunch of other guys. And so maybe try it differently, unless you've been booking them. If you're booking them, don't change. Do what's been working. But if you haven't been booking them, it's not like you've been doing a bad job. It's just that how are you gonna set yourself apart? So sometimes, like D. Bradley Baker tells this story, that the voice he does on American Dad, the fish, they wanted, I think, to be French.
Yeah, French, yeah.
Yeah, and he said, well, everyone's going to do French. I'm going to do German, you know? And D, I mean, D is also an artist. He's going to go with what he feels is the best way to express himself. But also, he has the luxury of knowing that, well, I work plenty, so my mortgage is not riding on whether or not I get this. So I'm not saying that was his thinking, but I'm saying that if you're in a position like that, you have the luxury of maybe playing a little bit and saying, I really don't care if I book this or not. I'd like to, but it's not going to crush me if I don't. So I'm going to give them something that is absolutely nothing like what they're asking for. And it may blow up in my face. They may say, well, this guy can't pay attention. What's his problem? Or they may say, wow, we never thought to maybe write the character that way. Or there's the character. I don't know why we didn't see it that way. It's a right. gamble. But sometimes I'll do it just because I don't feel like reading it the way they wrote it. I'll look at it and go, come on, man, you're going to get 100 other people doing it exactly like this. And I'm just tired of doing it that way. So I'm going to throw a Hail Mary here. Maybe somebody will catch it. It's really down to you. I mean, if you're white knuckling it and you really need to work and you got to book this gig, maybe sometimes that's when you stop playing it safe. You say, all right, maybe I want to set myself apart. Other people may say, no, I gotta do what they're asking for. I'm going to be a pro and I'm going to give it the way they're asking for it, because that means when they book me, when they get me into the studio, if they give me the direction, they know I'll follow it. So there's no roadmap for knowing when to break the mold. I honestly think you got to go with your gut.
And then one thing I want to ask you about specifically is with The Simpsons, you've been in over 250 episodes of The Simpsons, playing a lot of different additional voices and characters.
Yeah, it's always peripheral characters.
Right, yeah. Right. How do you go about bringing a life and a sense of humor to supporting characters? You know, when you're, you know, you've got two lines or something, how do you still make that character yours?
You do the most you can with it. Also remembering that maybe that character is not supposed to steal the scene. That character is there to set up a joke that's happening three lines down that Dan Castellaneta is going to nail with his Homer, or Hank is going to nail with his Chief Wiggum. And so you're just there to serve it up and let them smash it. You know, you're a team player. That's as valuable as that character is sometimes. Other times you're lucky enough where the joke lands on your guy. So you say, okay, sometimes it's purely a comedic instinct. You say, you know what? I see what they're doing. I see what the joke is. I'm going to play it like this. And luckily you're reading it for them. They're right there and they're going to say, okay, for this take, try it like this or try it like that. And sometimes I'll even ask, I'll say, what did you have in mind? Is there any particular way you want this guy to sound? And if they don't, you know, at this point, sometimes they'll trust me enough and say, hey, you know, what were you thinking? Because it's a small, you know, the plot's not hinging on it. So it really depends on the room. It depends on the atmosphere. If they're saying, yeah, go ahead and have fun on this take, do it. But they may get two takes from you where, you know, you give them exactly what they asked for. And it's really just about listening to what they're asking for. If a character only has two lines, yes, there are ways to imbue that character with a full life and a backstory and all that. And a lot of times it's just, look, the character's here to set up a joke. Set the joke up and take it seriously, because otherwise the joke won't work. If they don't believe the setup, they're not going to believe the punchline. So yeah, it's something that you can feel, you know, like one character is like, when I did Marv Sislak, that's Mo Sislak's brother. So Marv Sislak is going to sound like he's at least a Sislak. So, you know, he's not going to be Mo, but he's going to be kind of Mo's brother. So yeah, he's going to be hard bitten. He's going to be cranky. He's going to be ruthless. And yet he's not going to be exactly Mo, but he's going to be sort of in that area there. And that's kind of what they wanted. So you work with him on that. He had more than a couple of lines, but the idea is still the same. Does it make sense for what they're writing? Okay, try to make it make sense.
Well, and I think that, you know, what's interesting there that I think could be easily overlooked is a lot of actors will come to a small role like that and go, well, I've got to make this live. I've got to make it special. I've got to make them see me. And really what's making it sparkle for you is dependability.
Right.
is you get the casting director goes, okay, I know this guy is not going to be a handful. He's going to give me what I want.
Right.
Quick, easy, no hassle. Bring him in for more of those roles.
If you can do that, I call myself a Swiss Army knife. I am not the marquee voice actor. I can do a lot of different things for you. I can do them quickly. I will not take all day, and I will take suggestions. I don't even care if somebody gives me a line reading. If I'm not giving them what they want, like, give me a line reading. I'll give it right back to you. I'm a mimic. If for whatever reason what I'm doing is not landing for you, and you know exactly how you want it to hear in your head, give it to me, because I'll smash it right back your way, and you'll go, okay, that's what I wanted. Like, I don't have an ego when it comes to that. Now, if the entire direction is nothing but line reading after line reading, I'm thinking, okay, I'm a jukebox. Put your quarter in, and I'll play the song you want. You don't want the cover. You want exactly what you want. Fine, I'll do that. That doesn't happen on these shows, but I have done like video games before where the director just, it has become a line reading for every single line. And they just start with that. And I go, fine, if you want a parrot on your shoulder, I'll be that. You're going to pay me either way.
Right.
But there's no interpretation going on here, but if that's what you wanted, okay, you know, fine.
They want your vocal cords, not your skill. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. But I have found that, if a director trusts you, the animators like working with what you've given them. If the producers trust you, you will find that some of your work is going to be by referral. You're going to hear, oh yeah, so-and-so wants you for this. Like, I don't remember reading for that. You didn't. They have something they know you can do. And you'll go do it. And then you'll find in the same show, they'll bring you back 2 or 3 weeks later doing somebody else. You've never read for them. They just know, okay, yeah, he's reliable. He gives us what we need. No muss, no fuss. He's a bench player. And you can make quite a nice career for yourself being a bench player if you decide not to have an ego about it. And I've gotten to be the lead on a show before, and I am primarily supporting. They're all great. They're all great. They're all acting, and they're all using the tools that you've built. So yeah, like you said, you don't have to take a two-line character and you know, make everybody suddenly notice them, because that might not be that character's job. That character might be there to serve the rest of the scene and not call attention to itself.
Yeah. I think there's something to be said for that dependability. I think there's a lot of voice actors out there who, if they were given the choice between, okay, you get to be the lead in a 13 episode series, or they get to have the, I think, 197 titles that you have on your IMDb listing right now, man, that's not a hard choice. It really is. One of those is going to keep a roof over your family's head.
Right. Yeah. There is the question of just being pragmatic. And I'm not the kind of actor I am because I'm pragmatic. That's the kind of actor I am. But I have learned that if you are versatile, you can find many, many ways to work. And if your agents see that, then they'll throw you the auditions. I mean, that's their job to get you out there.
Yeah.
And once they trust you and you trust them, they'll give you those opportunities.
Yeah.
So
now with this talk of all these different supporting characters and stuff, that's not to say that you haven't had some amazing characters that you have played in your career.
You've been fun. You've got
some tremendous stuff. I would actually like to play with those for just a moment before we wrap up. We like to play games on this show, and I would love to play a game with you if you're up for it.
Sure thing.
Awesome. So we are going to play a little game called Cold Reads. So the way Cold Reads works here at We Talk Funny is I am going to send you something to read in a character voice. You can choose one of your favorite characters to read it as. And this is something you've never seen before. It can be literally anything. It could be anything with words. The only promise I make is that it's nothing offensive because we do try to keep this as a family show.
Sure.
But having never seen the script before, whatever it is, we're going to have you read that in a character voice. So which character would you like to pull out for us here? And we're going to throw a script at you.
You can choose if you want. Pick can something I choose? Off my IMDb.
Awesome. Well, you know how much I love Peter. Peter is my favorite character of yours. It's one of my all-time favorite characters on anything. So the first one that I sent you, this is going to be the very first time I've ever heard. Cold Read. This is Peter Potamus as Rick from Casablanca.
All right. I'm going to open this up. I am now seeing this. This is Rick as Peter Potamus. Peter Potamus is Rick. Here we go. Ready?
Ready. Let's do it.
Last night we said a great many things. You said I was to do the thinking for both of us. Well, I've done a lot of it since then, and it all adds up to one thing. You're getting on that plane with Victor where you belong. No. You gotta listen to me. You have any idea what you'd have to look forward to if you stayed here? 9 chances out of 10, we'd both wind up in a concentration camp. I'm saying it because it's true. Inside one of us, we both know you belong with Victor. You're part of his work. The thing that keeps him going. That thing! Did you get that thing, Tincha? If that plane leaves the ground and you're not with him, you'll regret it. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon. And for the rest of your life. We'll always have Paris. We lost it until you came to Casablanca. We got it back last night, but I've got a job to do too. Where I'm going, you can't follow. What I've got to do, you can't be any part of. Ilsa, I'm no good at being noble, but it doesn't take much to see that the problems of three little people don't amount to a hill of beans in this crazy world. Someday, you'll understand that. Now, he's looking at you, kid. From that thing I sent you.
That was fantastic. Oh, that was amazing. That was that. Oh, I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it. And just to do a bonus, we'll do one more. I've sent you one more because there's, you know, the kids don't remember Casablanca. So I don't know. Let's see. We'll go with maybe go with Pathfinder. I don't know.
Pathfinder
from Apex Legends. And we're going to go with something a bit more modern for the kids today, like the modern Apex Legends. This will be from the modern version of Casablanca, the kids' classic romance film. This is Pathfinder as Augustus in The Fault in Our Stars.
A movie I have not seen. Okay. I'm in love with you. I am. I'm in love with you, friend. And I'm not in the business of denying myself the simple pleasure of saying true things. I'm in love with you. And I know that love is just a shout into the void. And that oblivion is inevitable. And that we're all doomed. And that there will come a day when all our labor has been returned to dust. Wow, this is very sad. And I know the sun will swallow the only earth we'll ever have. And I am in love with you. High five!
Oh, that fit the voice so well.
I know.
That fits so disturbingly well.
Oh, yeah. That's the thing about Pathfinder. The darker the things he says, the cheerier he gets.
Well, listen, before I let you go, just a last thing. Do you have any words of advice for young voice actors out there who are just starting to get into the business?
Sure thing. Don't quit. If you love it, you will always find a reason to stay in it. It can take a while. I'm going to be 52 next week, and I'm in my peak years as far as the amount of work I get to do, the income I get to enjoy. And that was a result of 20 years of being in the business, and then another, 10 years of training myself to be a performer. So it is a long game. And in this day and age, especially with social media, everyone around you makes it look like they are having the time of their lives and they're crushing everything they do. Don't believe it. Don't fall prey to the trap that everyone else is doing better than you based on what you see on their social media. So-and-so just booked this. Oh, I'm living my best life. Oh, I just booked a bucket list job. Don't get distracted by that. Work at your craft. Learn to act. Learn to write if you can. Perform in front of people when you can, when it's safe. And cultivate your skill set and just be persistent. Don't be annoying, because sometimes persistence can come off that way. I know. And your time will come. If you are good at what you do, especially in voice acting, people will notice and the work will come. It may take longer than you want it to, but it will come. And the better you are, the longer you'll work. Don't worry. Don't be in a rush.
All right. Thank you so much, buddy. I really appreciate you being on the show here.
My pleasure.
Now I'm gonna end this the same way my mom always ended every Saturday morning period of watching cartoons. The show's over. Go outside and play.
Yeah.